The COVID-19 pandemic has introduced some new words and phrases into our everyday vocabulary, like social distancing and contact tracing. But what's old is new again. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Most people living today have never experienced a global pandemic like this one, but the experiences of our ancestors have been passed on to us through our language. This hour, I'll talk with Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. We'll talk about the language of this pandemic and pandemics past, and she'll answer your language questions and entertain your language pet peeves. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Before March of 2020, the phrase social distancing had never passed my lips. And there are so many words and phrases that are now part of our everyday language, words and phrases that are new to us, but not really so new at all. This hour, we'll explore the language of this pandemic and pandemics past with Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammar Phobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and she is on the line with me now. Hello, Patricia.
Hi, Charity.
It's so nice to talk to you. I hope you've been well.
Yes, I have. And you know, that's not just small talk these days. Yes, I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, that's not a new phrase at all, although I have seen people musing about how they end their emails with please stay well, take care, all kinds of good wishes that used to feel empty and don't feel empty in a pandemic.
No, they're not empty anymore.
I've also seen some musing about some of the other common phrases that refer to pandemics, like people avoid something like the plague. I've seen people say, we really need to retire that because apparently people aren't that good at avoiding the plague.
Yes. Right. Then it was probably a reference to the plague, the big disease.
Right.
No, this is not the plague, however. That question has arisen. Is this the plague again? No, it's not the plague.
No, that's a very specific disease and one that can be treated well with antibiotics, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Well, why don't we start with talking about some of these terms that we use now, like social distancing, but they were coined long ago, right?
Oh, yes. In fact, the term social distance has been around since 1824. It was first recorded in an article in a Boston paper about the interactions within women's Bible groups, the groups that contained women from all different classes, social classes. And it said that women of different classes mingled with one another more easily than men of different social classes. And the writer said that in general, and I quote, women are less separated by social distance. Now, that meant class distances. So it meant social in the sense of social classes. But in 1957, the word social distancing first appeared in print, at least as far as we know. It may have been earlier, but we can't find it. Anyway, social distancing in 1957 referred to physical or emotional separation between two people or between groups. Now, in the disease sense, it dates back to the big SARS epidemic of 2003. Do you remember SARS?
Yes.
Yes. Now, in 2003, social distancing was used in the medical sense there, and it meant maintaining a distance from people who are infected. So that's been revived now. 18 years later. So it's not new, it's just been revived. And generally today it means keeping a particular physical distance, typically 6 feet or more, both to stop yourself from being exposed to an infected person, as well as to stop yourself from transmitting the disease if you're infected.
Well, and it's an interesting phrase, I think. And again, I've talked with other people about this as well, saying, you know, we're talking about physical distancing. We're not actually talking mm-hmm. about social distancing, but it's a
True.
Phrase that everybody now understands the meaning of. And it mm-hmm. would be difficult
because
to try
it usually
to
means
alter
in,
it.
Right. It usually means in public, in a social setting. So we use social there just to mean with other people.
Right, right. And also meaning to stay home or avoid going into social situations as much as possible as well.
Right, and that brings us to self-quarantine. That's another very old phrase. Believe it or not, the term self-quarantine was used in a medical sense as long ago as 1876. It was first recorded. It was used in reference to a Philadelphia doctor. His name was Dr. Rutter, who was suddenly alarmed because he discovered he was apparently spreading puerperal fever. Puerperal fever, it's hard to say, among his maternity patients. As you know, that was a very dangerous disease in the 18th and 19th centuries. Very, very dangerous. Often fatal, usually fatal. And it was actually spread by midwives and doctors who assisted at births. They would, like, for instance, go from one maternity confinement to another without washing their hands, without changing their clothes or whatnot. Sometimes doctors would even go from an autopsy on a mother who had died in childbirth. They would be called out from that autopsy to go to another childbirth case. Mm. And so you can see how those things spread. At any rate, Dr. Rutter, in order to try to get a handle on this, he actually self-quarantined himself for a while. And the term self-quarantine was used in reference to that in stories that appeared in 1876. And since then, the term self-quarantine has also been used in references to other types of epidemics or disease spread. Like in the there was a terrible epidemic in 1916 of infantile paralysis, which we now know as polio. And self-quarantine was often used in the news in those days, and also in the great 1918 flu epidemic. So it's been around for a very long time. Now, the adjective form self-quarantined also dates from the 1870s. And in fact, the OED has a 19th century example from an Iowa newspaper. This is from the Perry Chief in Perry, Iowa, in January 1988. The quotation was, "No one was sick in the house but the self-quarantined woman." And the verb form, he decided to self-quarantine, that kind of thing, to self-quarantine, dates from the 1918 flu epidemic.
Interesting.
And it was also reported for the first time, that verb form was reported for the first time in another Iowa newspaper, the Mount Pleasant Daily News. The newspaper advised readers who felt ill, said, quote, "When feeling ill, at once, without delay, call a physician and remain indoors. That is, self-quarantine, and all will be well."
Advice we've been failing to follow now for,
yes,
for at least
for
a century.
Right? For 150 years.
Well, and the word quarantine, we use it all the time. We know what it means, but it mm-hmm. sounds like it's referring to a quantity. And that's not, of course,
yes.
how we use it. So
yes.
Tell me more about that word.
Well, this quarantine is a really, really interesting word. It was adopted from Italian, quarantena. In Venetian, a Venetian dialect of Italian, in which the word meant 40, it could mean 40 of anything. And in fact, it was used very early on in the 1400s to mean a 40-day period. And a quarantine meant a 40-day period of doing anything. And the first usage in the 1400s, a quarantine meant the place where Jesus fasted for 40 days. So in that case, the quarantine referred to a place. Later, it had other non-medical meanings. In the 1500s, it meant the legal term for the 40-day period when a widow was allowed her dower right, that is, her right to live in her late husband's home without paying rent to his heirs. So in the medical sense, quarantine, as I say, came from the Venetian word quarantena, which meant 40 days. And this became associated with disease because in 14th century Venice, ships arriving from ports that were known to be infected with plague, that's the plague, were required to drop anchor and wait for 40 days. At the end of the 40 days, which was called the quarantena, any survivors who were left were allowed to come ashore. So, I mean, those were tough times, I tell you.
Yeah.
I think there were lots of times when ships just stayed out there in the harbor full of dead people.
Wow.
But anyway, that's how we adopted quarantine. We took it straight from Italian in 1635. So that's the history of that.
Yeah, it does drive home again and again. You know, for most of us, this is the first pandemic, or at least widespread pandemic.
Right, but there have been pandemics, you know, regularly throughout history. And if any of us still have grandparents, great grandparents who remember some of these, like the polio epidemic of not only 1916, but polio epidemics kept popping out, different outbreaks, up into the 40s and 50s. In fact, I came across a news story in a college newspaper from the 40s where a fraternity had decided to self-quarantine itself because two of the members, the young college men, had developed polio. It was called infantile paralysis until the word polio came along in the 20th century. But they had decided to quarantine themselves. So it didn't just affect children and babies, but college students. It's generally the young, but even college students could be affected. So it's difficult to underestimate the importance of infectious diseases in history.
Yeah, and it's easy for us to forget.
Since we
haven't experienced it personally, we have a hard time thinking beyond our own personal experience, which we also demonstrate again and again. We are going to take a short break. My guest this hour is Patricia O'Connor. She is the author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. And we're talking about the language of this pandemic and pandemics past, but you are welcome to join the conversation with any of your language questions. Give us a call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. And we're talking about the language of this pandemic and pandemics past. But if you have been trying to keep your social distance and keeping your language pet peeves to yourself during that time, you are welcome to join the conversation. You can ask questions and share some of those pet peeves. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Patricia, let's talk about the word mask, because of course that's something that we talk about all the time now. now. We know that medical masks have been a part of our society for quite some time, although mask has multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm. Actually, mask in, you know, its ordinary senses has been part of English since the 1500s, and it's related to a Latin word meaning evil or hidden. And I probably because of, you know, the masks that were worn at mask balls and how people would hide themselves, and there was something sinister about hiding your face. As far as I know, I mean, it's had many, many meanings. I mean, there's even, you know, the masks that you put on your skin and your hair to improve them. I mean, they're all called masks, usually spelled the French way, M-A-S-Q-U-E, to be pretentious. But as far as I know, the word mask wasn't used until 1895 in the medical sense. That means something worn to prevent the spread of a contagious disease. So that's from the 1890s. And we've probably all seen the pictures from the 1918 flu pandemic of crowds of people wearing masks and street scenes of people masked and nurses masked and to prevent the spread of the flu.
Yeah, and every time I see those, I am so grateful that we have higher tech materials that make them more comfortable and more effective today.
But actually, you know, those fabrics they had back then might have been just as effective, maybe more. For instance, people are now wearing microfiber, those buffs, that, you know, the buff things that you can wear as a headband or as a neck muffler or pull up over your face. Microfiber materials don't work that well for keeping. I mean, they're too porous. They aren't that effective. The best things are plain old tightly woven cotton, which they did cotton very well back in the early 20th century.
I also wanted to talk
about, you know, sheltering in place. I had never heard this term, I think, before the pandemic. Sheltering in place.
I think the first time I heard that term was right after the bombing at the Boston Marathon, because there were wide orders around Boston to shelter in place as they looked for the perpetrators of that violence.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, that was new to me then.
Yeah, and I came to find out that term, to shelter in place, first was used in the 70s during congressional hearings about the nuclear threat. When you hear a public safety alert that there may be a threat of incoming missiles, you were supposed to shelter in place. And that just meant to not to stay home, but it meant to stop wherever you were and take cover until you hear an all clear signal.
So we have a bit of a different meaning today.
We have a bit of a different meaning now. And I think that the term shelter in place first was used in the medical sense as, you know, to stay home because of a disease threat. I think that was first recorded during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Interesting.
Another one is hunkered down. You know, people have emailed me about, isn't it supposed to be bunker down? No, it's actually hunker down. And that originated in Scotland in the early 1700s.
It sounds Scottish now.
It is Scottish. Yeah. So many of those things, if it sounds Scottish, it probably is. It meant literally to crouch down, squat down, you know, with your weight on the balls of your feet in a crouched position. In the figurative sense, to concentrate your resources, dig in, buckle down, lie low, and all those things. It was used in 1903, hunker down.
Interesting.
And it's been used, you know, it's been revived, of course.
Yes, much more metaphorical most of the time.
I'm hunkering down at home, taking care of business.
I want to get to the phones, and we'll get back to some of these words and phrases that are so common in this pandemic and pandemics past. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've got Amy on the line in Jewel. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What would you
Thanks
like to talk about?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My dearly beloved grandmother, she is 73 and lives about a half an hour from Des Moines. And growing up, she always wanted to be an English teacher, and she loves to read, but also a gramophobe. And she has many of these things that she says incorrectly that it just perturbs me. She still says Des Moines, and I'm constantly correcting her, but the funnier ones are her need to sound fancy by pronouncing CHs with soft Cs. All of them are cherry and chair instead of chair and cherry. And it's just a rolling joke between us when I'm correcting her.
But she also enjoys correcting others. Is that what you were saying?
She does. She will not let any grammatical error slide, particularly in a close relationship. She might let it go in public, acquaintances, but she doesn't let me slip even for a second.
Well,
there's a word for pronouncing a word because of the way it's spelled, as in Des Moines or Des Moines. And it's called a spelling pronunciation. And as you know, in English, we don't necessarily pronounce something the way it's spelled. In fact, we often don't. But that's called a spelling pronunciation. And I think pronunciations are very idiosyncratic. And maybe you should just think of it as part of her charm. One of the reasons you love her.
Absolutely. Amy, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let's talk about the phrase contact tracing, which I think is mm-hmm. an easy one to understand. We've been throwing it around a lot, but that has quite a history as well.
Oh, yes. As you know, it means identifying and monitoring individuals who may have had contact with an infectious person. This, believe it or not, dates from 1910. It first appeared in an article in an Australian medical journal about the duties of school nurses in any kind of infectious outbreak. And the author wrote that school nurses often help with the work of school health inspectors who can't be at all schools at all times. They help by contact tracing, among other things. That's 1910.
Wow.
Now, another term that has been popping up lately, community spread, dates from 1903. Now, this means it was first used in reference to leprosy and in 1903. And what it means is the spread of a disease within a community among people who haven't traveled, haven't had known contact with infected people. In other words, there's no known reason why it's there. That's what community spread means. And it usually happens at a certain point during a pandemic.
And the
So that's another old one.
Right, right. And it's so interesting to think about those terms and our less complete understanding of how diseases spread back
yes.
then, but we were
yes.
obviously trying to make sense of it. I also, in thinking
sure.
about contact tracing, of course, technology helps us with that in so many ways, but it must have been much simpler back
yes.
in 1910
yes.
to try to figure out who had been where and in contact with whom.
Yes. In fact, along that same subject is the term super spreader, which I have first heard during the COVID-19 pandemic. It turns out that it first appeared in print in England in 1973 in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. And it still meant then what it does now. It meant an infected person who spreads a pathogen to an unusually large number of other people. and it was used originally in reference to AIDS. But since the 70s, it's also been used in reference to typhoid and now, of course, the coronavirus.
Wow.
So we adapt our old vocabulary to new situations.
And then it changes slightly over time as well.
Certainly.
Which is interesting.
Actually, there's another interesting term I'd like to mention. It's not that it's so common, but I found it interesting because it arose out of a misconception, and that's the term patient zero. Patient zero dates from the early years of the AIDS epidemic, and it originally was patient O with a capital O, which stood for outside, and it originally meant an outsider who brings an infectious disease into a community that didn't have it before. It was first used in the early 1980s in reference to a person who had been identified as the first AIDS carrier to introduce HIV into Southern California. Now, this was the early 80s. Later in the 80s, the term patient O, capital zero, was misinterpreted. The capital O was misinterpreted as the numeral zero. So writers began spelling out the term patient zero. And the term came to mean not an outsider, but the first person to be infected with a particular disease. And since the late 80s, patient zero has been used in reference not only to AIDS, but to tuberculosis, and now COVID-19. So what started as patient O for outsider became patient zero for the first patient.
Interesting. Well, and
so I thought that was fun.
Thinking about AIDS and how it traveled mm-hmm. around the world. I know at the beginning
yes.
of the pandemic, we did spend some time, not you and I, but people talked about, you know, the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic. And
uh-huh.
AIDS did travel around the globe. And of course, it's still a terrible problem in many places. Let's
yes.
talk about those terms, epidemic and pandemic, because I think some of us use them interchangeably.
Right. Well, we should start with outbreak, because before you get to either epidemic or pandemic, you have a small, localized, sudden increase in the incidence of a disease, and that's what's known as an outbreak. That word entered English in the 1500s, outbreak, and it's one of these words that was actually created within English, with English parts. It didn't come from another language, but it originally just meant an eruption or something like that. And it was first used in the medical sense in 1832 when a British newspaper used it to describe a sudden rash of cases of cholera. Now, an outbreak, as I said, it's just a sudden localized increase in a disease. The outbreak becomes an epidemic when it becomes widespread within a specific community or population. It's not just a handful of cases, it's widespread. But in a particular population at a particular time, all at the same time. That word was first used in 1603 in a book about how to treat plague. Now, the epidemic becomes a pandemic when it spreads throughout a country, a continent, or the world. So the word pandemic, it goes from outbreak to epidemic, then to pandemic. And an easy way is to remember by the Greek prefixes epi means on or upon or close to, similar to epicenter, while pan means all, you know, as in pantheism. And the demic parts mean the people or the public. So AIDS did become a pandemic when it spread throughout the country. It wasn't just in one city or one state or one community. It was countrywide, and that's the definition of a pandemic.
Right. And, of course, many countries around the globe as well. Let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number. Susan's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, there's a wonderful book. It's called The Cry and the Covenant I read it probably 20 years ago now, but it is specifically about these doctors that would poison these women after birth, and, you know, by going from autopsies to the maternity wards. And it's just that it's a wonderful recounting of that. And then it really ends with the beginning of Listerine, you know, where doctors, this guy had these doctors wash their hands because they were infecting all these women. And literally the women would go from the, it was safer to have your baby in the street than it was to go into a hospital.
Yes, invariably, women who have their babies at home, unassisted, never got puerperal fever. See how carefully I pronounce that? They didn't get it. It was given to them by midwives or doctors. And it's interesting, I did a lot of reading about this because it's such a fascinating thing. There were people in the early 1800s campaigning to get doctors to wash their hands. One man in particular named Semmelweis. They were ridiculed and hounded out of town, these people, because the feeling among physicians was, well, doctors are gentlemen, and gentlemen don't need to wash their hands. It was considered an insult to tell them to wash their hands. Isn't that interesting?
I
just find that so amazing. But yes, they would go right from the autopsy table, treating that very, you know, to determine the cause of that very disease, and then without washing their hands, they would go to the next case and pass it on. So yeah, it's an amazing story. I should look up that book.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor. She is the author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English, and also blogs at grammarphobia.com. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And, of course, they are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question from Twitter. From Annie. Richard, what is a type of grass I can plant on a steep hillside, something that would not require frequent mowing?
Well, obviously, you could put in some native grasses. They do just fine. They don't have to be mowed. For example, there's a little blue stem, Indian grass. Now, these are fairly tall plants, but they would do fine. They have a very deep root system. And once established, basically very little care.
All right. That's the dream, not having to mow that hillside. So I think that sounds like a great plan. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Harvey's on the line in Mason City. Hi, Harvey.
Hi. I planted in the front of my yard late last August, probably. I had new sod put in, and it's been doing pretty well, but now it's turning kind of brown in spots. Can I just let it go and it'll recover next spring? Or maybe I better start watering it?
Well, I think if you're in a dry part of the state, you may want to go ahead and start watering. And I would try to put on about an inch, inch and a half a week. I would try to do that in one application or two applications about 3 to 4 days apart. And do that, and then maybe go ahead and fertilize around mid-September. And with the cooler temperatures, with the moisture, with the fertilizer, that should revive it, and it should look much better by late September or October.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Harvey. Next up, Corinne in New Providence. Hi, Corinne.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I had a question about horseradish.
A couple years ago, I was gifted part of a very old stand of horseradish. I got it transplanted successfully, and it's taken beautifully at my house. So I had a question. I have never dug up and tried to, you know, I can and do things like that regularly. So I was wanting to process the horseradish. How would I go about digging it up? Like, how much should I do? What time of year should I do it? And then also for transplanting, when I move here in about a year, do I do the whole thing or leave some of it? How would I go about doing that?
Cindy?
Yeah, so with horseradish is pretty durable, and you can really dig it up anytime from spring through mid to late summer, if depending on when and how you want to use it. So it's a root system that's used. I wouldn't dig up the entire thing. I would dig up just a small portion since it's only been in maybe a year. And then you're going to dry down that root a little bit. You're going to peel it, and then you're going to process it into a cream or, you know, food process it or dry it, kind of depending on how you use it. You don't need much horseradish to go a long way. So that's kind of the good thing about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you can just even grate it, I think, and use it in things. I'm not the cook, so probably how to process it and how to keep it and store it. The answer line might be better, or maybe Richard knows. But I do know the plant itself is pretty tough and will tolerate repeated harvest during the growing season if you want to take a little bit here and a little bit there. And do the same thing when you're ready to move. Just transplant, take a little bit with you, and you can put it in a container. It'll do well in a container, and then you transplant it to your new garden whenever you get there.
All right, Richard, do you have anything to add?
Well, horseradish can't become a weed. It's a very vigorous plant, and so I would harvest it every year, and in doing so, I would use the bigger roots, and then I would take off some of the smaller ones and plant those for next year. But it can be very, very aggressive, so I would harvest it every year, definitely.
Perfect. That answers all my questions.
All right, Corinne, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Penny in Iowa City. Hi, Penny.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for letting me talk to you.
Sure.
I have pin oaks in my backyard, lovely, huge, tall pin oaks. And I know you are not supposed to, you know, do any pruning or trimming of those trees until it gets cooler. And I have someone lined up to do that, you know, in the late fall. But in the meantime, I have a deck, and the pin oak is, you know, reaching over the deck, and it's growing into my, you know, sun umbrella and just kind of causing havoc on my deck. And I'm wondering if I could just trim those branches, you know, that are kind of impinging on my umbrella and so forth, or would that be risky?
No, you can. What you want to do is get some latex house paint and a brush, prune off your branch, and then immediately paint that surface with the latex house paint. You're basically kind of sealing it so that there's nothing to attract the beetle that transmits oak wilt. So that's what you want to do.
Okay, well, that's easy, I think. Perhaps I'll start decorating my tree now. So,
all right, Penny, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Mary is up next in Perry. Hello, Mary.
Good morning. I want to know if you can plant perennial grasses in the fall and what type of grasses would be appropriate for landscape areas.
Cindy?
Yeah, you can plant perennial grasses in the fall. I usually like to plant larger perennial grasses so they're in larger containers in the fall because they're really doing their thing sometimes in the fall. And you want to have as much of an established root system or a big root system if you're doing some fall planting. As far as options, you have lots of options. There's some smaller ones like, you know, I'm thinking of the feather reed grass. Sorry, go ahead, Richard.
Prairie drop seed,
the dyschampsia, which is kind of a hair grass. There's blue oak grass. There's also some taller ones like the miscanthus and the big blue stems and the switchgrass. So you have lots of options. Sometimes you're limited on availability at a garden center, but they should have plenty of grasses because this is the time that they're often seen and sold, and they work really well in the landscape. So,
okay, I appreciate your answer.
Just
thank you.
Yeah, water them well, and then I might mulch them well this fall or winter as well, so just so you know where they're planted, because you'll have to cut that back in the spring or in late winter, and you'll know where that new plant should emerge.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go back to some email questions here. This one's from Char. My Bobo, Little Lime, and Annabelle hydrangeas are blooming fine, but my favorites, Endless Summer, have not produced one flower this summer. They have eastern exposure, and I fertilize and water as usual. The bushes are green and healthy, but no buds. What do you think happened this year? Richard, I think you must know what happened this year. That was a knowing laugh.
That's a big leaf hydrangea, and they are extremely finicky. They just, they're not reliable. And some people refer to them as endless bummer or something. It just, it just doesn't bloom very well. So the best that you can do is wait in the spring, let it leaf out, and then just cut out the dead wood, because it can bloom on old wood and new wood, I believe. And hopefully it's going to bloom. Make sure it has plenty of moisture. It has those big leaves. And if it's dry, they wilt very quickly. So make sure it has plenty of moisture. And just realize that it's probably not going to bloom that well some years, and some years it will. There are some improvements on that variety. Bloomstruck is an improvement, where it tends to bloom more reliably than Endless Summer.
Okay, so maybe pick a different favorite. Is that the advice that I'm hearing?
Well, if it disappoints after so many years, it may be time to replace it.
All right, we have another question about hydrangea bushes on the line. I wonder if it's similar. Laura's on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Yeah, that was my question. That's pretty funny. The same thing I have, but I've had great luck in the past. This has been a beautiful plant, and this is the only time this summer that I only got one big, beautiful blossom and then nothing else.
Yeah, that's just the way they are. They're just not like the panicle hydrangeas, the smooth hydrangeas. They'll bloom reliably every single year. The big leaf hydrangeas, they just don't. If this is a bad year, but most years are good, I think you're doing something right.
All right, Laura, thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Roberta. I've noticed yellow leaves and wilting showing up on previously healthy lilacs and viburnum and boxwood in our Ames neighborhood, and it seems to be a widespread problem. What's going on? We have lots of oaks, and some have yellow leaves and bare branches. Any thoughts, Cindy?
Well, I don't think it's all the same thing. I mean, there might be some drought stress that could cause some of this, but I don't necessarily think it's a disease that's, you know, hitting everything. So if it is an environmental issue, check the soil to see if maybe that lilac or the boxwood needs to be planted. And then this one might be, you know, you take some pictures of some individual plants and send it into the plant and insect diagnostic clinic, because there might be something going on with the boxwoods, and there might be something going on differently for the lilacs or the viburnum. Does that make sense?
And Richard, you want to add anything to that?
Well, if the symptoms are fairly uniform, where the leaves are kind of yellow, one thing that could be would be a lack of moisture, because if they're dry, plants under stress, some of the leaves will turn yellow and maybe drop off prematurely. If it were a disease, they tend to be very, very plant-specific, and something that would attack a viburnum would not attack a boxwood, typically.
All right. And it's not entirely unusual for plants under stress to start showing fall color this time of year, right?
Right.
It's not.
Right. When plants are under stress, they typically give you some type of warning sign, like maybe wilting, yellowing of foliage, early coloration, that type of thing.
All right. Here's a question from Larry in Elkader. We have lilac bushes of various sizes and ages. The leaves on some appear totally dead and brown. Some have patches of dead leaves. Others seem healthy. Any suggestions on what might be happening? Richard?
That definitely sounds like a disease. And we're seeing quite a bit of that this year. So what I would suggest is taking two or three photos and sending those to our plant diagnostic clinic. Take one or two photos of the entire plant and maybe one or two photos, close-up photos of the affected leaves, and send those to the clinic. Their email address is pidc@iastate.edu. So pidc@iastate.edu.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We still maybe have time for a couple more calls. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. From Greg, I've had consistent success preventing this tomato fungus issue by heavily mulching my garden area with springtime grass clippings from my mainly bluegrass lawn. This also helps with moisture control. Before the grass goes to seed, I bag all the clippings and lay down a very thick layer, then plant the tomato in a small clearing and install the cage around it. The only problem is that robins can detect worms under it, and they insist on flinging the mulch hither and yon.
So they do that.
Right. That takes us back to that comment from a listener about tomatoes. But again, if you don't move your tomatoes, you're going to have some trouble.
Right. But growing them in a cage, mulching may reduce the severity of the disease, which may allow you to get a crop. Watering and applying the water directly to the ground, all those things may help maybe delay it or reduce the severity.
All right. And here's a question, Cindy, from the Dearth family. What is the best time to divide hostas and what is the best time to divide lily of the valley?
So hostas you can divide almost any time that it's growing. You can divide them now or late August into September. They're easier to divide in the spring just as they emerge because you have less foliage to deal with. So that's one possibility. Usually with lily of the valley, it's the same. This is a tough plant. It's equally as tough as hosta. So you could divide that in spring. But if you do it in early spring, you're probably going to impact how well it flowers that year, which isn't necessarily a horrible thing because then it'll get established. If the lily of the valley still looks good now, you can divide it in August and September and water it heavily, and you still may not get as good flowering in the spring, but it'll have a little longer to establish a root system.
All right. Bob in Rock Island says, we have a blue clematis that has never been too robust, even after 5 years in place on the south side of our house. This year, it has wilted from the vine ends back to the main stem, leaving only one strand appearing to be alive. What are the diseases of clematis and how are they managed? We're thinking simply of removing this plant and trying another cultivar. Richard?
Well, it's called clematis wilt, where very suddenly you'll have one or more stems or vines simply wilt and die very suddenly. And oftentimes they'll come back. But there's no real cure, no prevention. If the plant overall is not performing well, there are many, many varieties, and I might want to choose a different one.
All right. And last question. Luke in Cedar Rapids, I planted a 3-year-old, 2-foot-tall Japanese maple emperor this last spring. We moved it into our house over the winter before I knew how much shade the area I planted it in had. It only gets 2 hours per day of sunlight at the most. What will happen if I leave the tree at the current location, and what do you recommend?
Well, this one does like some shade, so it does okay in some shade. It doesn't usually have great fall color if it's in shade, and usually it is one that you have to kind of bring in year after year over the winter because it's not reliably hardy in all of Iowa. So it should perform okay. It may not be at its best. But, you know, if you have a Japanese maple and you're keeping it alive year after year, that's pretty good.
All right. We are out of time. Cindy Haynes, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and we will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.